The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Oh, wonderful.
Scuff my nail polish.
Oh, played in there. By Orla Shinemi. Orla, didn't know you couldn't play the piano.
My list of non-talents are endless.
And then with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
What are we doing here? What are we doing?
I've no idea. It's the end of season, and it's silly season almost, isn't it?
Almost. We're in Cardiff. We're in St. David's Hall, where we are doing an event tonight, and that event will be this week's podcast, hopefully. All things, if it goes all right, it'll be this week's podcast.
Well, and if it doesn't go all right, thank you, we'll be back next week.
But what we're going to be doing, we're going to be reading extracts from our Grand Tour diaries. You're doing the Giro, Lionel, I'm doing the Tour de France. Orla, you're doing the Women's Tour.
Yep.
These diaries will be released as our first Friends specials of 2019. They'll be coming out very soon when we launch our Friends programme for 2019. Audio diaries from the three Grand Tours plus the Women's Tour. These are just extracts we're hearing tonight, not the whole thing, Orla, remember?
I know I'm in danger of getting a bit overexcited. New material.
But I should say we're in St. David's Hall at the invitation of Joanne John, who works here and is a listener to the podcast. And when she heard about our tour earlier this year around various venues, we went to Salford, a couple in Yorkshire, Nottingham, Glasgow, Edinburgh, London. And she wrote to us asking if we could come and do an event in Cardiff sometime later in the year. So here we are. That day has come, and we're expecting a big audience and really looking forward to it.
Sold out, isn't it? 300 and something people. Nerves are jangling. What time's curtain up? And where, can we have some kind of drink to settle my nerves?
Yeah, we'll order that in a moment. Before we do, this is our 11th show that we've done this year. You've been in most of them, I think, Orla, or quite a lot of them anyway. What's the routine?
Well, usually what we have been doing is reading from a chapter from our book, or a bit of our chapters from our books, A Journey Through the Cycling Year. And then that leads to a bit of discussion. We chat the cycling year that's been and gone, and then open the floor to questions. And that's always a good bit of the night for me. Not that the rest of it is not good, but it's a bit nerve-wracking when you're reading out your own writing live on stage, isn't it? It's very exposing. But the questions then is when it all gets nice and relaxed and good fun and everything. So I'm expecting lots and lots of Geraint Thomas-themed questions this evening, being where we are.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with RAFA.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, RAFA, for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And I must mention a new book, Queens of Pain, which has been published by RAFA and written by Isabel Best. We featured this book in the last Cycling Podcast Femina, didn't we, Orla? We had an interview with Isabel as well.
Yeah, we did. She was talking to us about the book, which features a whole host of different stories through the history of women's cycling. Some well-known, like Jenny Longo, and some really obscure stories that I think will surprise quite a few people, but are really, really interesting. It's a wonderful book, and it's gone down very well as well. It's got an awfully popular, well-received reception. It's been very well-received.
It has been. I enjoyed reading it, certainly. And it is available at rafa.cc if you want to have a look for Isabel Best's Queens of Pain. And there's an interview, as I mentioned there, in the most recent episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina. That's November's episode, which is packed with stuff, as per usual. But there's an interview at the end of that episode with Isabel Best on the book.
What I love about all the Rafa books, Rich, is that they have been put together with such expertise and love. They are really beautiful publications. As someone who's put together a few books in my time, you can really see the love for the subject has really gone through the whole sub-editing team, the design team, the people who've conceived the package. It's a lovely book, Queens of Pain.
Everybody, wow. Thank you very much for turning out in such large numbers. Fantastic. My name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney and Orla Shinui.
Hello, hello. Oh.
And I should say at the outset tonight, we are recording this episode, this event to release this week as our episode. So we need a lot of audience participation. Cheers, booze, whatever.
Keep the heckling clean, please.
Whatever. Anything at all. Anything at all. I'm sure Lionel will do his bit to alienate the Welsh, and that'll. he normally does that. But before we crack on, Lionel, ble rydym ni.
Oh. Does anybody speak Welsh? Was that Welsh? Yeah?
More kind of.
Yeah, there we go.
I've been told that means where are we? Is that right? Excellent. Going well so far. Well, we are in the hometown of the reigning Tour de France champion. There we are.
It's...
oh, that won't get picked up, will it, unfortunately? Never mind. It's a delight to be here in Cardiff. Next week, we're in Johannesburg. Week after that, we're in Kilburn. Then it's Christmas.
Or Ghent,
possibly, yeah. Yeah, it's great to be here. It's been a fantastic year. You'll notice that Geraint Thomas features in our backdrop photograph here. This was taken by Simon Gill. We're the only podcast in the world that has an official photographer. And this picture was taken on Alpe d'Huez. Geraint's in the yellow jersey, of course. Chris Froome doing a lot of help, sitting in his slipstream. But Chris Froome and Simon Gill have a kind of an arrangement where any pictures that Simon puts on his social media, Chris Froome can then put on his Instagram and his Twitter. And when Chris Froome posted this picture, he cropped it just to the right of the church spire.
Simon was looking at it, wasn't he? He put it on Instagram and this wonderful picture, and Simon was looking and going, something about that doesn't look quite right.
The framing of it slightly off.
There was a whole bit of it missing.
And it's still on Chris Froome's Instagram as the crop picture. I checked for coming on tonight.
In fairness, on Instagram, you have to post square pictures. So, you know, I mean, we'll give Chris Froome the benefit of the doubt.
You have been very generous, Lionel.
But he couldn't crop he couldn't crop Geraint Thomas out of the GC, could he? So, you know, that's what counts really, isn't it? So, or is it? Social media followers, is that not what it's all about now? I don't know.
So what we're doing tonight is... last year we kept Grand Tour Diaries, which featured in our book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, which is available for sale at the back of the room. We've done Grand Tour Diaries again this year for the Giro, the Tour, the Vuelta, and the Women's Tour, and they will be released as Friends special episodes in the next few weeks. But we, since we've written these things, we thought we'd try the material out on you lot tonight. So this is gentle. Yeah, this is your guinea pig. So this is all new stuff. In fact, Lionel hasn't heard what I've done, and I don't know what Orla... You know, none of us have heard any of this stuff, so it's new to all of us.
But it's really good. I mean, it's just quite
nerve-wracking. So we're going to start at the Giro. Let's take us back to the Giro, Lionel. Have you memorised it? I mean, where's your bit of paper?
Oh, wow. Don't worry. Very well prepared, Richard. The ink's still drying on this. I only finished it yesterday. But before I started, I actually had a question for the audience. After the Tour de France, how many of the people in this room suddenly remembered they'd beaten Geraint Thomas in track league when he was about 13? Honest, hands up, I'm sure. One at least, good. Yeah, a couple there at the back.
Been dining out on that since July.
Well, you know, I mean, I beat Conor Dunn at Hillingdon once. He was about 12, 6'2". But, you know, a win's a win, isn't it? Right,
So back to the Giro. This is the day before the Giro. The Grande Partenza, Daniel's not here to correct that, so we'll go with that. It's going to be dominated by two questions. Should the Giro d'Italia be in Israel, and should Chris Froome be in the Giro d'Italia? I've spent weeks reading extensively, and as I board the EasyJet flight to Tel Aviv, I still don't know the answer to either question. I used to be a very nervous flyer, to the extent that I would arrange alternative travel if it was at all possible. And although I'm okay now, it's still a bit of a shock when half an hour into the flight, the captain comes on, talking in that peculiar upper-middle-class drawl they all have. It's as if the whole business of conversing with anyone who can't actually fly a plane themselves is a lot of unnecessary bother. In a way, I suppose it's quite reassuring. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm afraid there's a problem with the flight. In the past, this would have had me gripping the armrest. This time, I think, oh well, if anything really bad goes wrong, at least I won't have to decide whether or not Chris Froome should be riding the Giro. It turns out they'd forgotten to empty the plane's toilet tank at Luton Airport, and as it was now nearly full, we had a choice. We could either avoid using the toilet unless it was absolutely necessary, or we could divert to an airport somewhere en route, adding hours to our journey time, missing our landing slot in Tel Aviv, and generally causing a lot of inconvenience. Immediately, I'm bursting for the toilet. But I'm assured by the steward that number ones are not the problem. This turns out to be a relief in more than one way. Already, I can sense that my general ignorance of the major religions of Israel is going to catch me out this weekend. I used to be a fairly committed atheist in the Richard Dawkins, Ricky Gervais, Stephen Fry mould, but I've softened a bit as I've got older. I still don't believe there's a lucrative round of post-tour crypts after life's final stage, but I'm no longer silently dismissive of those who do. In terms of geopolitics, I count myself as curious and reasonably well-informed. Listeners to the podcast might dispute that. But the more I've read about Israel, the more confused and conflicted I've become. I can see both sides of the argument, but I'm already realising this is not enough. Every time we've talked about the Giro's decision to start the race in Israel, we've had criticism from both sides. As journalists, we often tell ourselves that if people on both sides of a debate or dispute are critical, then we've probably got the balance just about right. But to receive emails accusing us of both anti-Semitism and of not caring a jot for the plight of the Palestinian people, it doesn't give me any reassurance that we're getting anything right. What I can't understand is the accusation that by covering the Giro in Israel, we're legitimising Israel. I also see no sense in boycotting the Israeli stages, because our job is to cover the bike race, report what we see and hear, and add context if we get the sense we're not seeing the whole picture. As we drive out of the airport and through Tel Aviv, I see the offices and billboards for some of the world's biggest companies. I think back to the times that England or Chelsea have played against Israeli opponents in competition. During the classics, I'd watched adverts during Eurosport cycling coverage encouraging people to holiday in Israel. So it seems peculiar to me that it's the Giro that is seen to be giving Israel legitimacy when Israel already hosts businesses and holidaymakers. After checking into our hotel, we walk down the road, as directed, to the American Colony Hotel, whose past guests include Lawrence of Arabia, Winston Churchill, Bob Dylan, Uma Thurman, Richard Gere, Giorgio Armani, Tony Blair, and Mikhail Gorbachev, and now the cycling podcast. As I record this, 6 months have elapsed, and it's disappointing to note that the hotel has not updated its website accordingly. The courtyard is shrouded by a canopy formed of trees, plants and shrubs, so it feels a little like being indoors, outdoors. We order a mezze and a buffet of Middle Eastern snacks arrives. Hummus, pita breads, smoky baba ganoush, feta salad, I've cut this down a bit, stuffed vine leaves, little lamb kebabs and other delights that were equally tasty but less familiar. With the plates and dishes covering the table, my hands dart left and right and cross over like a one-man band reaching for half a dozen instruments in quick succession. Richard asks for the wine list and orders something local. Good choice, says the waiter. It arrives and the waiter is not wrong because it's delicious. After a while, I ask Richard, how much was it? I don't know, it was near the bottom of the list of reds. I reach for the wine list and note that the wines are not listed in price order, so being near the bottom of the list does not indicate cheapness. I compare the wine list with the label on the bottle and feel my eyes widen when I see the price, 420 shekels. Remembering that each of our delicious dishes range from 3 to 9 shekels, a quick calculation tells me that either the wine is very expensive or the food is impossibly cheap. The baba ganoush can be only fractions of a penny. Did you work out the exchange rate, Rich? No, he replied, sipping wine from the glass held in one hand while reaching for the last lamb kebab with the other, probably. The currency converter on my phone tells me that the bottle of wine is around £90. Richard, that bottle is around £90. He pauses chewing only momentarily. Oh well, we can't send it back now. Bloody hell, Buffalo, that's the equivalent of 6 friends of the podcast. We don't make a habit of such extravagant spending, except when Francois is around. But to all of our friends of the podcast, and I hope there are some in the room, at least 6 of you anyway, I say cheers. I hope you've enjoyed our coverage this year, and thank you for your support.
Oh, it takes me right back. Lionel.
Was it good wine?
It was absolutely delicious.
Wouldn't
wine.
Need to be.
Yeah, really good. Worth every penny.
Did you have a second bottle?
No.
No. Straight to the beers.
Yeah.
We didn't. But yeah, it seems a long time ago, doesn't it, Israel? Mm. And all that build up and then 3 completely inconsequential days of racing.
That's what was the funniest thing about the whole build up to the Grand Pretenda this year was all of the fuss over whether it should take place in Israel or not. And even, I guess, the distance they had to go. And then it was completely boring. Was that just...
Well, me? That... Was it,
the racing?
The people in the room... I mean, the 3 days in Israel were quite underwhelming. I mean, obviously, Chris Froome had his crash before the time trial. That was quite exciting and a talking point.
Not
obviously.
For Chris.
No. That was a talking point. But other than that, there wasn't an awful lot that really happened. I think for everybody, the riders, the teams... The challenge was to get Israel out of the way and get back to Italy without anything bad happening in terms of, so much could have gone wrong logistically and the travel. And, you know, it was quite complicated. And that journey back from Israel to Italy was, you know, very early start and a long flight. Mm. So there was a lot to get out of the way. But I guess
I took that flight with the teams, and being a nervous flyer, I was quite relieved to be on the same flight as Sunweb, so Tom Dumoulin, Team Sky, Mitchelton Scott, so Simon Yates, who else? EF Education First. And I thought, well, if this plane goes down, I'm not even going to get a mention. Seats were allocated, I don't know how, quite randomly.
On which flight would you get the mention, Lionel? I'm curious.
You what?
How far
down? Which flight would you get the mention?
Cargo plane.
I sat next to the Team UAE rider, Norwegian Vegard Staker Langen. I think I've said that correctly. He was reading a book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F***, which I thought was quite interesting.
And we didn't start this on an explicit language warning.
We'll just have to bleep that.
Bleep that one out. Yeah.
You'll have to imagine the bleep.
But I mean, I guess the most notable thing that happened from a racing point of view was actually Simon Yates finishing 7th in the time trial, in a short time trial, which really showed us that he was in fantastic form. He's pretty good at these sorts of events, but that was
bike racing.
Well, no, but you know, he's a little climber, but he's just a good all-round cyclist. He's good, decent time trials. This was the best one he'd ever done. And it was a real red flag about his form. This guy's clearly come here in top shape, and so it proved. And Simon Yates was the story of the first, well, all but the last 3 days of the Giro, wasn't
he? And even then, he was still the story.
Yeah.
Well, you remember in Israel, Matt White, he's kind of the Ladybird book of body language. He can't conceal his delight or disappointment, can he? And after Simon Yates' performance in that time trial, only 9.7 kilometres, I think.
Oh, look.
Exactly. He couldn't hide the fact that he knew that Simon Yates was going incredibly well. And, of course, for the first 2 weeks, he was the story, wasn't he? It looked like it was all wrapped up, particularly as Froome kept losing time. You know, 40 seconds here and having bad luck. He crashed before the time trial. He crashed again on the stage that Richard Carapaz won. Didn't lose any time, but his front wheel slipped. And we had this sense that he was the momentum was completely against Froome. And it was until the final Friday, when it was quite decisively with Froome, wasn't it?
The only thing that was missing, really, was a nickname for Simon Yates, wasn't it? That was the one thing that was lacking.
Yeah. We did our best to correct that. We went on one of Daniel's magical mystery tours. He likes to take us off the beaten track at the Giro to show off how much he knows about Italy. And we went to a place that was supposedly the Zonkalan of the South. And he told me on the way this story about how some people on an internet forum in the early 2000s had basically started talking about this mythical climb somewhere near Salerno that was harder than the Zonkalan. And the story got picked up by a website, cycling website, and then by a newspaper, and then by another newspaper. And before anyone knew it, the Giro organisers were kind of answering questions about rumours that the Giro would go to the Zoncolan of the South. The only problem was there was no such mountain near Salerno. There was a hill, but we were stood at the bottom of it. And I mean, it looked like the sort of thing that even I could have got up. So we were talking a bit about internet rumours and how, you know, fake news before Donald Trump made the phrase famous, you know, can infect sport. And I was lamenting the loss, the great loss of the nickname, the riders being given nicknames like the Eagle of Toledo or the Ferret of Firenze.
G.
Yeah, the romance of the nickname. Economical, at least, isn't it? And in the press room that afternoon, I just said to Daniel, what's the Italian for black pudding? Because Simon Yates is from Bury. Bury, as everyone will know, is famous for its black pudding, delicious, healthy sausage. And Il Sanguinaccio Volante was born. And Daniel's, I mean, if you can't see head shaking in a podcast, so I carried on with this. And we tried to get this nickname into the Italian press. We failed, but we did get it onto the front page of Het Luister News Belgian sports section. We got it onto BBC Breakfast, Sky Sports News as well. Had a little bit of help there. But yeah, I don't think it's not one for the ages, is it? I think we'll dampen it down now. But we tried our best.
Yeah, yeah. And Simon Yates became
aware of
it.
He's trying his best to dampen it down, certainly.
The first day he went with it, did you know you're being called the Flying Black Pudding? And then the second day he kind of went with it, but a little bit less. And then the third day he denied any knowledge of it.
And then he was still on his mind, obviously, at the Vuelta, you know, when he atoned for his disappointment at the Giro and went on to the Vuelta and won that. And on the second last day at Andorra, when I was back behind the stage and everything, and he'd come off the red jersey presentation, he'd won the Vuelta. And he made a detour to tell me that we have to come up with a different nickname for him.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Seb Piquet, the voice of race radio at the Tour de France, interrupting our live show there to remind us to tell the listeners that this episode of the cycling podcast is sponsored by Harry's Razors. And Harry's have a special offer for cycling podcast listeners. You can get a trial set for £3.95, which is basically the cost of the postage. And all you have to do is go to harrys.com/cycling. What do you get? Well, the Harry's Razor trial set includes everything you need for a close, comfortable shave, a weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Now, Rich, it's very important before we appear in front of a live studio audience to look presentable, and you
don't. Right. I shaved yesterday, Lionel. Still pretty smooth. I think that's a good endorsement, isn't it?
I think so. Almost as smooth as my baby's bottom.
I'm on the... Thank you. Nicest thing you've ever said to me. I'm on the Harry's program now, where I get spare blades sent to me as and when I need them. But actually, they're piling up because I've told them I shave twice a week, which I do, like a bit of growth, you know. But actually, I find that I use the Harry's razors quite a lot, probably more than I'm supposed to. So I think that also is an endorsement. They're very good.
So they send you... You don't run out and then have to go to the supermarket and get replacement blades and all
get
that.
Get the security lock taken off them and all that nonsense.
Yeah, that's a right faff, isn't it? They just turn
enough,
up.
Enough to put you off, isn't it, Lionel? Yeah. Anyway, special offer for cycling podcast listeners. Get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. Support the podcast and get your trial set delivered to your door. That includes the razor handle, the 5-blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel, and travel blade cover. Go to harrys.com/cycling right now. That's harrys.com/cycling.
Shall we move on to the women's tour, Orla? Because, well, it was the first time we've covered it the way that we cover a grand tour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We decided to give it our grand tour treatment. So myself and you and Rose travelled around each of the stages and tried to give a little bit of a flavour of not just the racing, but what you guys do as well in terms of the, I guess, the culinary specialties on offer or the history or any sort of cultural links that we could find along the way. So this is a short extract from my bit of the women's tour. This is from Saturday, June the 16th, Stage 4, Evesham to Worcester, 131.5 kilometres. Stage winner, Amelie de Derrickson. Leader on GC, Corin Rivera. An unexpected element of covering the women's tour, perhaps due to naivety on our part, was the incredibly sparse live coverage given to the race, despite its prominence on the women's calendar. We've become almost blasé about being able to immerse ourselves in every move, every break, every flick of the elbow in a race. As a journalist, we can suffer from information and armchair analysis overload, but it's what we've become used to. Women's racing rarely has the luxury of the live TV cameras needed to facilitate such indulgence. At the Women's Tour, there was a very good daily highlights programme on ITV and plenty of print journalists at the race each day. But for the podcast's aim of being the first outlet to have a comprehensive reaction to the day's racing, as well as full race reports with some sort of coherent narrative and extra colour thrown in for good measure, we were largely operating in the dark. Mostly, we had only the official race Twitter feed to go on. Here's a sample of tweets from stage one. Kilometre 20. It's been a cagey start to the stage with the riders waiting for each other to make the first move. Race all together. Kilometre 35. Despite a split in the bunch at the Queen of the Mountains at Christchurch Park, the bunch is now all back together. Kilometre 57. The race is heating up with action at the front of the peloton. However, no moves have managed to stick. Not a single name, not a flourish of detail, nothing to help colour the race beyond the general outlines of vagueness. Then a moment of tension. We're currently experiencing a loss of signal in the race convoy. We'll be bringing live text updates again once we get it back. Could this be the part of the race where we would have been given the key details we've been craving? Was the stage blowing itself apart and we just didn't know it? I can't stand it. I need to know what's going on. Kilometre 80. We've just passed the 50 to go marker. Phew, we're back. The bunch is currently all together, despite several attempts to get away. Really? That's what we missed? And for the geeks among us who just love a bit of detail, the pace is high in the peloton, which is strung out in a long line. To stand in this information void is to be completely unaware of whether what happened on the road was worthy of our soon-to-be projected excitement on the podcast or not. Sure, we know the winner, but was the racing any good? Did it really all stay together until the final few kilometres? Or was there any indication of alliances formed and broken, team rivalries exploited and strained, key protagonists showing moments of weakness? Strangely, it became quite liberating to go about piecing together the day's events from scratch. It felt like a throwback to the, shall we say, more creative days of sports journalism, when moments of greatness were shaped in the public mind by the imagination, flair, and to a certain extent at least, journalistic skill of the stringers and reporters ringing in their copy. It may be self-indulgent to borrow a perceived romanticism and transpose it onto your own actions, but certainly every race finish involved a dash around as many riders as possible to get their take on the day's action, with little or no prior indication of what had happened during the stage, painting the picture with as broad a brushstroke or as fine a detail as only our conversations could allow. On stage four, as it happened, there was plenty of excitement to report. An early crash with five abandonees, a temporary neutralisation, a disagreement between the three escapees, Charlotte Becker, Cecily Utrip-Ludwig and Audrey Cordon-Rigaud, a crash in the final 3 kilometres and an eventual win for former world champion Amelie de Derrickson, which was her first Women's World Tour victory in over a year. No shortage of drama to discuss on that evening's podcast, or at least that was our take on it, and few will have been in a position to contradict.
Yeah, I don't think we were quite prepared for that, were we?
We really weren't. And that's when I started to write that bit. It did surprise me that we were so surprised, really, because I think as well, if you're not following a race and living and breathing a race as we have the luxury of doing when we're covering it, you assume that you miss out on key details because you've been busy. So you think it's because you've been at work or you've been looking after the kids or you've been going about your ordinary life. And you only manage to get snippets of the race because that's all you've got room for in your mind. And so that's what I assumed was going to be the case for the Women's Tour until we got there and I realised that's actually all the information that there was available. And it was really quite surprising. Even to the extent on the first stage, we were trying to follow the Twitter updates. And again, I mean, I've mentioned a few of them there, but the last 10 kilometres, for example, all we had were things like Bols Dolmans are taking control at the front of the bunch, all heading for a sprint finish. And then the next update would be beautiful and sunny in Southwold. Can't wait for the finish. 3 kilometres to go. Sprint is on. And then the result. And it was only when the riders crossed the line and we went to interview everyone that we realised it had been carnage for the last 10 kilometres. And riders had been falling off left, right and centre. Abby Van Twisk had lost consciousness in the last 200 metres. And none of this had come out on the official Twitter feed. And I completely understand why, because they had a race protocol and they wanted to make sure that everybody was okay before they put anything, you know, public and make sure that families weren't unduly worried. But as journalists, it left us in a really strange position then, because we assumed that the information we're getting is correct, when really it was just a very, very, very limited sanitized version of actually what was happening.
I mean, the great thing about a bike race is you have every day, no matter that you can see a lot of it on TV, you have every day 180, 160, 180 different stories. And, you know, the women's tour, when you've got a rider, don't want to laugh, but when you've got a rider crossing the line bloody and battered and bruised, and you, the only way to find out what happened to them is to go up to them and say, "What? Can you tell me what happened?" You know, and that's not... It's not a great moment to approach a rider ever. If you've seen it on TV, you've at least seen what's happened. But, you know, I did an interview this year with Jean Bobet, the rider from the 1950s, whose brother Louis Jean Bobet won 3 Tours de France. And in his book, which is a beautiful book, he talks about journalists coming to his hotel room in the evenings to ask him what happened during the stage. And that was how they put their reports together. They literally visited the riders in their hotel rooms. And that's very old school. There was a lot of poetic license in those days, I think, as a result of that. But it must have been great fun. And the women's tour was actually great fun.
I think it keeps... Well, the coverage of the women's tour, it had a kind of rawness and an honesty to it, because television seduces you into thinking that there's one version of events on a particular day's racing. And as Richard says, there isn't. There's 100-odd different stories that you could tell. And the job is to kind of try and... you're sifting for gold, I guess. You're trying to get the good stories, you're trying to piece together as accurately as possible what you can do, whereas with TV coverage you're kind of you believe you've seen everything there is to see and know. And you say it's old school, but I mean, when I started, you know, 98-99 covering the Pro Tour, which I think came not far from here, another Welsh place called Swansea, I don't know how you get on there, but
I knew it.
But there was a stage that went up Constitution Hill, and I was in one of the press cars, and all we had was the race radio. There was no TV coverage until, you know, 7 o'clock at night. So that wasn't an option. And the tweets you read out, I mean, that brought it all back, because you would just have number 54 is off the front of the peloton, a gap of, you know, 20 metres or whatever. And you would piece together, you try and you get your nuggets of information and then piece it together at the finish by talking to as many people as possible. And I think it's relatively recent that we've had this blanket coverage. If you read Cycling Weekly as recently as, you know, those years, 98, 99, a lot of coverage of the Premier Calendar races or many stage races would be based on that sort of information. And the reliance on TV can be dangerous. I'll tell a quick story about a colleague of ours who I won't name, but he went to cover the Critérium International, which is a 2-day race in the south of France. And the first day is a road stage, and the second day there's a short stage in the morning and a time trial in the afternoon. And he covered the morning stage as normal, went out, interviewed Chris Boardman and so on, or how are you hoping to go in the time trial. And then he went to watch the time trial on the TV in the press room, watched it, saw Abraham Alano, the Spanish rider, win the time trial, take the race overall. And as soon as the Alano crossed the line, he dashed out to where the team buses were, and everything had gone because the TV coverage had been delayed. It was not on live.
So this was a friend, was it, Lionel? Friend. A good friend. Well, no, but I had a similar thing this year at the Ruta del Sol at the start of the year. You were there as well, Orla, briefly, but we were there because Chris Froome was riding, and there was a stage that finished up a little hilltop in a tiny, tiny little town, and there was a lovely restaurant at the top, and I'd gone in there, I was having lunch, and... watching the action on the big screen, which was out in the square, and there were people there, you know, not huge crowds because it wasn't a massive race, but there were enough people. I was watching the race unfold, sitting there eating my food and thinking, I've got loads of time here. And I saw him come onto the lower slopes of the climb and thought, right, I better go out there and see what. And as I was getting up and going out, I sort of heard a cheer, and there's Tim Wellens crossing the line. the TV was on a delay, and it was a good three or four minutes, but it was enough for me to basically miss everything that happened and not know. And then, it was like the women's tour. It was a good preparation for the women's tour. Mm-hmm. I'm out there, so Tim, can you tell me how, talk me through the last few minutes?
The classic general
talk
question.
Talk me through the last few minutes.
Well, what I really enjoyed about it was a reminder that you can't get it wrong, because sometimes I think when there is this oversaturation on Twitter, and you don't have to be anywhere near a television screen, you just know certain people to follow on social media who will give you blow by blow every single move. And it makes you feel like there is a set narrative to the day. And especially if you're supplementing that with television coverage, it feels like everybody has to decide on the one story. And actually with this, I love that we were going at it completely with a blank slate, and that we were able to fill in the gaps whichever way the stories came to us. So it would be, you would have gone off and gotten four or five interviews, Rose the same, me the same. And when we came back together again, that all formed some form of a narrative. But again, it was only ever the little corners that we'd managed to populate of the race, really. And I find that really refreshing.
And then you had the day with Drops, where you witnessed Manon Lloyd, local girls, and Shane Manon. Yeah. And that, again, another side of the race, something else, very dramatic, arguably that day, more dramatic than what was happening at the front.
Yeah, absolutely, because I was at the Trek Drops car on the day that, I think it was stage three, maybe, and they had a rider in the top 10. Eva Berman was on eighth. They had Abby Van Twisk, who had just pulled out because of the crash on stage one. They had Hannah Payton, who was very sick overnight. And they went into the longest stage of the women's calendar this year, thinking that they were up against it, and didn't realise just how difficult the day was going to get. And I happened to be in the Trek Drops car, 25 kilometres in, there'd been a crash, the car was called to the front, we were called to the ambulance, and then Manon Lloyd spent, 30 kilometres, I think, out the back of the race, trying to get back into the back of the race again. And for me, the perspective of that was just fascinating. I love being in a team car when you're somewhere near the back. This was further back than I've ever been before. But to be able to witness that part of a story where you're listening to Bob Varney, the team boss, shouting words of encouragement, gently and sparsely, so as to not be overwhelming Manon, but giving her directions at the same time and making sure that her head was in the right place, that she was going in the right direction. It was a real privilege to watch that battle in a way that you'll never get to see it on television. And a reminder again that there are just so many stories on any one given day in a race, which is what makes the sport so beautiful, I think, as a journalist anyway.
Shall we move on?
Let's.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. The code for 25% off all your Science in Sport products is SISCP25, SISCP25, and that will get you 25% off at the checkout at scienceandsport.com. Now, this week's question for the Science and Sport expert, Ben Samuels, comes from Duncan Crossley. Duncan asks, with the myriad of choices available from Science and Sport and other sports nutrition brands, it's sometimes tricky to know what to pick and how to combine the products. For instance, are the isotonic Go gels designed to be used on their own with water, or should a rider use something else too? In really hot weather, would a rider need to add more electrolytes to the dose provided by the Go gel? Is there a database for stuff like that? Thanks from soon to be friend of the podcast, I promise, Duncan Crossley. Well, let's hope so, Duncan. Over to you, Ben.
Really, there's no one-size-fits-all approach. The best way to combine products into fueling on the bike is the way that works for an individual. While there is a number of options available, a rider's preferences, and in that way, trust and adherence to a fueling strategy shouldn't be overlooked. Having said that, there are some points that you should be following for in-ride nutrition. Mainly these are around carbohydrate intake. Of course, duration and intensity are going to be two big factors in overall fueling requirements. But if we're talking about longer rides, you should be looking at 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour. Now that can come from a range of options, such as energy gels, bars, real foods, drinks. But look to taking something every 20 to 30 minutes of your ride. A commonly used strategy would be to have food or bars during the flatter, less intense section of a ride, then switch to gels, carbohydrate, fluids during the higher intensity sections, as those are going to be easier to digest when the riding really gets tough. An isotonic gel is such that you don't need additional water to aid digestion, like you would with a hypertonic gel. In that way, hydration, as it relates to fluid and electrolyte intake, would be a separate strategy. There's no database as such where everything is kept and all this information is, but the athlete advice section of scienceinsport.com would be a great place to start.
Well, I'm going to do two stages, if I may. Is that okay? It could be quite long.
It's all time, right. Time for, set your alarm.
So we're at Tour de France, sort of beginning of the second week, Tuesday the 17th of July, stage 10, Annecy to Le Grand Bornand, 158.5 kilometres. Winner, Julian Alaphilippe. Yellow jersey, Greg Van Avermaet. That is right, isn't it? He was in the yellow. He was.
You wrote it.
Yeah, but I have a crisis of confidence about this. Geraint Thomas took it the next day, didn't he?
Yeah.
Is that correct? Yeah. This is like, can live fact check. There's a lot of uncertainty in the room, I feel. Greg Van Avermaet, we go with Greg Van Avermaet? Can we all agree?
Yeah.
He was in the yellow jersey.
Yes, Le Rosier.
We'll get to that in a moment. An early start because, as well as stage 10 of the tour, today was the day of La Course. As Orla and I drove to the start, we began recording our thoughts about the race for the podcast. You won't have heard that conversation because it was so unrelentingly negative that we decided to bin it. But to summarise, we thought this year's race, a short mountain stage starting early on a Tuesday morning, barely 48 hours after the end of the Giro Rosa, was a piss-poor effort by ASO. You also didn't hear it, because the race itself was an absolute belter. Well played, ASO. It was attacking and aggressive from the start, with one team, Cervelo Bigla, taking it on and putting the strongest riders under pressure. There was a nail-biting finish when Annemiek van Vleuten pipped Anna van der Breggen in the last few metres, and there was a gushing interview with Cecilie Uhtred-Ludvig, the young Danish rider that endeared her to anybody who witnessed it or happened to be watching TV on a Tuesday morning. One of my favourite things about La Course is seeing television's Daniel Freeb so out of sorts, frantically searching Google images for the riders he's about to interview.
we're in trouble.
Cut that out of the recording.
Do not.
He'll never listen to this.
He's not here. He's not going to listen.
Daniel doesn't follow women's cycling as closely as he follows men's cycling, which, before anyone gets angry, is fine. There are only so many hours in the day, and I don't think people have to watch women's cycling. If they want to follow only men's cycling, that's fine. They want to follow only women's cycling, that's fine too. I enjoy watching it, but don't think the way to make women's cycling more popular is to shame people for not watching it, even though that's what I've just done. But there's a lot of this sort of thing on social media, and of course there's a lot of virtue signalling, and some of my colleagues are not immune. Quite a few harumphed at how little coverage La Course got in the next day's papers, a legitimate grievance if they had actually bothered to go to the race themselves. Postscript. Julian Alaphilippe won stage 10 of the men's race a few hours later. 18th of July, stage 11, Albertville to La Rosière, 108.5 kilometres. Winner? Louder? Got a ban on G, remember. Yellow jersey, Geraint Thomas. Lionel and I thought we'd be smart at the finish and drive from the press tent to the team buses down the hill. Our heavily branded Skoda was parked just outside. Starting the engine, I noticed something on the bonnet, glistening in the scorching sun. A dog turd. I was pretty sure it was plastic, but not confident enough to not go in search of a stick with which to remove it. Eventually, I found one and gave the vile object a poke. It was plastic. We never did find out who put it there. We scanned colleagues in the press room for shifty looks, and furtive and furtive glances, and our suspicions centred on Rob Hales, though he denied it under intense questioning. I'd say he remains the number one suspect. It was a dog turd sort of a day. In the morning, we stopped for petrol. I filled the car up, and then at the start in Albertville, realised my wallet was missing. Once the stage was underway, we drove 45 minutes back to the petrol station. No sign of the wallet. The 45-minute drive back, retracing our steps on a twisting mountain road, passed in an uncomfortable silence. Few things put a damper on the day so much as a lost wallet. The emergency 150 euros that was in it, the tedious phoning of banks and cancelling of cards, the knowledge that for the rest of the tour, I would be relying on Lionel to pay for everything. Oh well, every cloud. A lot happened in the stage, but one experience that will stay with me was over an hour after Geraint Thomas won at La Rosière. Lionel Orlett and I were making our way back to the press room after doing some interviews when, just beyond the line, we bumped into Rod Ellingworth, Team Sky coach. I just thought I'd come down to see Mark, he said, meaning Mark Cavendish, his former protege. Cavendish had been way off the back all day, but despite being certain to finish outside the time limit, he had carried on. In doing so, he was holding up the entire entourage of the tour. All the team cars had to wait until the last rider was through before they could head down the mountain. But it seemed more important to Cavendish to finish. He said a lot about Ellingworth that, despite winning the stage and having riders placed first and second overall, he made the effort to come and support Cavendish in his hour of need. We stayed in an enormous and beautiful house that the listener, Simon Lund, had offered us. The vast interior wasn't quite finished, but it didn't matter. The house was situated at the foot of the climb to La Rosière, and it was spectacular. As was the food Simon had arranged for us, a large chicken, huge dishes of lasagna and moussaka, all the snacks we could eat, and enough beer and wine to last a week, or a night, as it turned out. As the wine flowed, the conversation echoed around the bare walls and got louder and louder, and more animated. It was a lot of fun, though the podcast we recorded before dinner perhaps lacked fun. Although it had been an exciting stage, we'd had a difficult day. On top of everything, we'd taken a wrong turn on the way back down the mountain, which meant a 20-minute drive ended up being closer to an hour. To cap all that, Orla seemed not quite herself. Travel sick, perhaps. She'd spent the day in the Cofidis bus with Cedric Vasseur. Sounded a bit dodgy when I read it, but it didn't when I wrote it. Maybe go back and rephrase that. But she seemed only about 50% as bubbly and enthusiastic as she usually is, which still meant she was 50% more bubbly and enthusiastic than the rest of us. Unfortunately, this all contributed to the podcast being a little flat, but I think this also, to a sense, conveyed strongly by Francois, who is generally right about these things, that the race was over. Sky were too strong again, and the only question for Francois was who would win, Thomas or Froome. Well, I knew what I thought. And I said it with feeling on the podcast. Can we have clip one, please?
I think it's completely fanciful to think that Geraint Thomas is a potential Tour de France winner. I just don't see it happening.
I stand. Really come to season.
I stand by that. I still think it's fan. Did he? Did he do it? Did he do it in the end? Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Wales won, Scotland nil. But yeah, he did win the tour, didn't he? And awkwardly enough, a few weeks ago, I met Geraint Thomas in London and did an interview with him. And to my surprise, he told me this.
I listened to it, you know.
No.
It was funny because after the tour, obviously it went really well for me. So I was like, oh, I'm going to listen to a few podcasts, see what people were saying. And what was that word? Fanciful. Yeah. Appreciate that, yeah.
I love it. After that, Richard, I was chatting to you on the phone and you said, you know what, I did notice actually after the Tour de France that Geraint Thomas stopped following me on Twitter. Now I'm understanding why.
Oh, he was furious. Oh my God. Oh, well,
in a very mild manner, yeah, Geraint Thomas kind of way.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, we had an email actually after we played that interview a couple of weeks ago from somebody who said that they felt that we had completely underestimated him throughout, you know, me and writing him off in the way that I did. I didn't write him off, let's be clear. I mean, I'm in Cardiff. I didn't write him off.
You still want to get out the door.
I wish I'd thought to say this to him at the time. I just thought he was too nice to win the Tour de France. You know, Francois always says, but lots of people always say, Shane Sutton always used to say, you need that ruthless streak. You know, you need to be prepared to crop people out of photographs on Instagram and you need a real ruthless, selfish streak that winners require. But then, you know, when we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, Larry Warbass disputed that. He said he knew guys who were winners. Tom Dumoulin was the example he cited of somebody who is a winner and I can also be a nice guy. And I'm not saying Chris Froome is not a nice guy, but there is a ruthlessness to him, undoubtedly, that we've seen on occasion. And I think we would have seen it at the tour if he'd had the legs. And I think ultimately he didn't have the legs. But Geraint Thomas
said in his book that
no matter that he was in the yellow jersey, Froome, if he'd been able to try and win the tour, he would have tried to win the tour.
Undoubtedly. But, you know, Francois always brings a bit more history to these debates than perhaps we can. And he was right. I mean, that night we recorded the podcast and, you know, there wasn't an air of celebration, was there? Because we were a week into the race, a week and a, what was it, stage nine?
And we'd had a dog turd on our bonnet.
We had a dog. Yeah. With an event as long as the tour, you know, the whole history of the race is kind of dominated by people who have dominated. Merckx, Eno, Indurain, Armstrong. We're very, very used to the tour being over, sometimes before it's even begun. I mean, I wonder sometimes how we would cope covering the 70s tours of Eddie Merckx, where he used to win the prologue and then his team would win the team time trial and then he'd win the first stage with any kind of hill in it on, you know, the stage three or four, and he'd be in yellow and that would literally be it. And then he'd win by, you know, 7, 8, 9 minutes. You know, we're so used to it being finely balanced. But what was really unusual about this year's tour was that it was kind of finely balanced but without the suspense, because I think we knew that Geraint Thomas would almost have to implode to lose the tour. And as the days went on, it just looked less and less likely that was going to happen.
I think, to be fair to you as well, Richard, most of his team didn't think he was going to win it at that stage. I mean, I was in the Team Sky car with Rod Ellingworth the following day when he won up Alpe d'Huez, and Rod was the only person that I heard who said, bloody hell, he's going to win it now. There's nothing to stop him taking yellow all the way to Paris. And even at that stage, I was surprised, because I expected, I guess, it may be a more official line from Rod. But I thought, well, will he be given that freedom for a start to be able to race for himself? But we were all expecting at some stage the typical Geraint Thomas bad luck to kick in. And from reading his book, it seems like most of the rest of the team didn't necessarily expect him to win until midway through the final week. I mean, I was at the Team Sky after party in Paris with Geraint Thomas celebrating his win, and he'd had a few drinks, so the truth was finally starting to come out somewhat. And he was thanking all of his team, you know, and he said that whenever he crossed the line in the Champs-Élysées and had his arms in the air, he said one of his first thoughts was, bloody hell, I have to pay all these lads a bonus now. And then his second thought was, actually, I only have to pay them for 3 days, because that's all the length of time that they actually worked for him. And he was joking, but he was only half joking. So until the final 3 days, he accepts that most of the rest of his team didn't think he was going to win it.
Wasn't that the point? The reason for the flatness was that the tour was over, in the sense that Sky kind of held the destiny of the race in their own hands, and they could almost pick and choose. And when you thought it was fanciful that Geraint Thomas could win the tour, the only feasible alternative was that Chris Froome would usurp him, take the yellow jersey as when they chose, or if he faltered, Froome would be there to pounce. So it was a strange day, that, really. We probably should have given him a bit more credit, maybe.
Well, but it does, you know, my retelling of what had happened that day does add some important context, because when you're there, because we did get a bit of feedback, didn't we, from people who expected something a bit more upbeat, and it so much depends on your, you know, where you are. We were in a beautiful house, but it was a different setting for us.
We stepped away from the race.
We were outside the race to some extent. We'd also had a terrible day. We were all. You know, down about that, and so it's funny to, you know, when I went back and listened to it, I could hear that flatness and felt myself, you know, that what happened that day was obviously hugely important, and it was the first mountain stage that Geraint Thomas had won. He'd taken the yellow jersey, you know, everything looked to be going his way, because you're already there almost halfway into the race, and unusually for him, he had. he had survived, you know, that first week and a half. I spoke to Rod Ellingworth 2 days ago, actually, or was it yesterday? What day is it? Tuesday. It was yesterday. Spoke to him at length about this. And one, you know, again, it goes back to the point we're making in the last conversation about that there being so many stories at the tour, and it takes years sometimes for things to come out. And he was talking about Luke Rowe and the job that he had at the tour. And for all that Chris Froome was the leader, they wanted to keep Geraint Thomas as a plan B and protect him to some extent. And Luke Rowe was given this really important job to make sure Geraint doesn't fall off in the first week. That was his job, you know? And I'd never heard that before, but he said, you know, I because Rod, you know, is obviously very close to Geraint and to Luke. And, you know, he would have wanted him to have had as good a chance in the tour as possible. And so going into it, there are a few things, one or two things in the book about the work that he was doing in Tenerife, where he was the leader of the Tour de France team that was preparing there for the tour. And he was doing the work that Froome would have been doing had he been there, and doing it well, by all accounts. So the team, there were certain people in the team, Tim Kerrison, was already thinking, physically, he's not far off Froome at his best here. So he could do it. I think the difference is psychology. But the point Rod was making was Luke Rowe, the job that he had to do. And Luke Rowe will have stories about, you know, certain moments, the cobbled stage or other flashpoints where there would have been moments where Geraint Thomas would have come close to falling off, because everybody does. And it'd be great to go back and actually relive the tour with him. Maybe we'll do that.
Well, we were flat at La Rosière, but imagine how flat Chris Froome was. I don't think he put anything on Instagram that night.
It's funny though, isn't it? I think in the end, Froome was reconciled. He probably felt at the end that the best man had won. You know, that actually he didn't have it to win. And I think he'd have been annoyed had he been held back and been told not to attack, but he was given an opportunity and he couldn't take it.
And I think that was part of the beauty of Geraint Thomas's win as well, because nobody can look back on the 2018 Tour de France and wonder what if, you know, what if Chris Froome had been allowed to attack or had been allowed to race in his own way, in the same way that you look back at the 2012 Tour de France and there are lots of questions over Sir Bradley Wiggins. I think for Geraint Thomas that's a massive factor as well, because he knows that he was the best racer, the best rider of the race, and that win is 100% justified. And to go back to what you're saying about, you know, the feedback of people saying that there wasn't maybe enough enthusiasm or it wasn't upbeat enough, it's funny because, like, our role as journalists is quite a precarious one anyway. I mean, you want to be, as British journalists, as British-based journalists with an audience that's largely in Britain, you do want to be excited about any sort of homegrown story. And certainly Geraint Thomas is hugely popular as a rider, as a person. But you can't really cross that. You know, it is a fine line. I mean, we saw at the World Championships recently when Alejandro Valverde won the world title. And there was a female Spanish journalist who was in tears, in hysterics backstage. She was so happy that Valverde had won. And to us, that was just completely alien more than a little bit uncomfortable to watch.
And I think, we're all aware of the reaction that sometimes you get if you're perceived to be banging the drum for a home rider. And so
especially with Team Sky.
I feel far happier on the podcast being excited about the emergence, especially young riders, you know, when they come through and they haven't done anything yet. But that's exciting. And I'm more comfortable being excited about a young Dutch rider or a young French rider. You know, it's just interesting the effect that has. Will Geraint Thomas win another one? Is the question.
This is your chance to write him off, Richard.
I'm not even going to answer the question.
You haven't done it in public yet.
Hands up if you think Geraint Thomas will win another Grand Tour.
Another Grand Tour, yeah. My hand's going
up. Geraint, if you're listening, everybody in the room put their hand up.
Geraint, if you're listening, me included, Richard and Lionel kept their hands down.
He will be listening, of course. Can you follow me on Twitter again?
Hashtag desperate. Oh, but do you not think he'll win another Grand Tour?
No.
Really?
No, I don't.
Giro?
Come on, Lionel, just one Giro.
Just a little one.
No, I don't. I don't think the stars.
Do you think it's fanciful to suggest that?
I'm not falling for that. I think the Giro is hard for a rider like Geraint Thomas to win. I don't know why. I don't know. He just, like I say, the stars aligned absolutely perfectly for him. You know, without dredging over all the races he's lost or the fallen out of contention because he's fallen off, it's been an amazing run of bad luck that he's had. He's ridden through at least one tour with one with a fractured pelvis. He's fallen off at the pointy end of Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders. He got very close to contending for the win in Paris-Nice one year and fell off with a day to go. This is going down well, this, isn't it?
Yeah. Talk about losing your audience. Jeez, any more? But you haven't mentioned the crash at the Giro last year, and then at the Tour as well.
Lander. Yeah.
But then to flip it around, though, he has had an awful lot of bad luck, fair enough, but he didn't have this whole team structure again around him at the Tour de France that was just focused on him winning. And the way that, again, to go back to Sir Bradley Wiggins, the way that all the team instructions were around protecting him, he wasn't the protected rider. And that gives me a little bit of optimism that he would be able to do it again, because he did do it on his own merit. And the stars aligning were simply that he stayed upright as much as anything else.
Mm. At least we've got something on tape now to play back in the future when he wins the Giro next year. But it's an interesting...
Base is covered, I think.
I
think he may win another Grand Tour one day.
Oh, shameless.
Oh, goodness me.
Cheers, team. Well done.
Cheers. Cheers, Arla.
Cheers, cheers.
What are you doing?
I'm insta-storying at the same time. Oh. Multimedia, Richard. Welcome to 2018.
Well, you know, can you do two things at once? Can you do that and also reflect on... We've just finished. We're in the curry house now. That's the tinkly music in the background. Here we are. I need this curry, eh? Went on a bit there.
We did, didn't we? But what a very warm room at the St David's Hall in Cardiff. An enjoyable evening, wasn't it?
Well, it was a very warm room, and it seemed to be getting warmer towards the end. I felt like we were like frogs being slowly boiled. I think they would take the hint eventually.
I felt like that, because I've got my own central heating at the moment as well, and I was wearing a cape to try to cover the bump ever so slightly. By the end of the night, I was melting slowly inside the folds of my throw.
But you heard the first part of the evening there. We carried on with questions from the audience. We had some absolutely cracking questions. We took some from the floor, and people also wrote questions and left them in a hat at the front of the stage. There were some real good questions there, weren't there?
There were some good questions, and what we will do, we'll do an end-of-year press conference episode, I think, and we'll answer some of those questions from tonight, and we'll answer questions from any listeners who want to tweet or email us a question. How do we... No, hang on. They phone in a question, don't they, on the WhatsApp number?
That's what they do, yep. That's cast your mind back, Lionel. So that's about it for this week, but we should remind you that the readings that you heard in this episode were from our forthcoming Friends specials. They're almost like audiobooks rather than Friends specials. Daniel Freeb, Francois Thomaso have also contributed to our Grand Tour diaries from the Giro, the Tour and the Vuelta, and Orla on the women's tour.
And I have to say, because we actually only listened to each other's chapters or extracts of each other's chapters tonight for the first time, I thought they were quite good. Quite enjoyed it.
Hopefully people listening felt the same.
Don't give away the fact that this is all coming together really at the last minute, Orla. This has been planned and it's been in the can for months. But yeah, it's more an audiobook than a Friends special. If you bought our book last year, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, well, earlier this year, but it was about last season, similar kind of style. And we thought three specials released in the run-up to Christmas would give people plenty to listen to over the festive holidays.
So I think, week one will be the Giro, week two the Tour, week three the Vuelta, and the Women's Tour will come out in between the Giro and the Tour, so it'll follow the chronology of the year. And you will be able to access those if you become a friend of the podcast for 2019. That will be launched very, very soon. A couple of people asked us if they can buy Friends packages for Friends as presents. Yes, you can. Email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. We can arrange that. It's £15 to become a friend of the podcast for 2019 again. But you can pay a little bit more if you are feeling generous and if you want to support the work that we do. as a few people, well, quite a few people did this year and last year, and of the highest donating friends, struggle with that, highest donating friends, we asked those people for ideas for a friend special, and a guy called Stephen Harris was one of the people who submitted some ideas, came out with a very good idea, how to retire. That episode, which was made with Stephen as guest editor, has just been released. It's a two-parter. The first part is us talking through all the ideas, and part two is the episode itself. And it turned out pretty well. Juan Antonio Fletcher's there, Fabian Cancellara, Chris Hoy, Matt Heyman, Tom Wheelers, and I think maybe somebody else, but I can't remember. And Geroid Towey, who is a former Irish rower who now works with Education First on helping the riders transition to retirement and planning for the future. Really interesting, actually, what he said. And as I say, that's available to Friends of the Podcast for 2018. And the 2019 Friends of the Podcast packages will be available very, very soon on the same terms as this year, thecyclingpodcast.com.
Freezing the price, Richard. Controversial. I mean, did I vote to freeze the price? I guess I must have done. But what great value.
Well, if people feel it's not enough, they can, as I said, pay a little bit more. And lots of you do. We really appreciate that because it really does. It helps us cover more races. And we've got lots of big plans for next year, haven't we, Orla?
We certainly do. We can't really reveal much of it, can we? But we've got very, very exciting plans for next year.
We do.
I'm a bit.
New direction.
Yeah.
Watch this space. That's all for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Orla.
Thank you both.